Chapter 12, Jolly Green Giant. I greatly enjoyed our association when you were premier. I particularly appreciated your presentation of the need for people in public office to consider issues of environment and sustainability. That cause has made great strides since you were pioneering it in the 1970s. Former Saskatchewan Premier Alan Blakeney, letter to Alex Campbell, 1999.
Too often, instead of concentrating directly on the goods and values we want, we have emphasized growth, exploited the environment faster, and assumed that good things would automatically follow. Premier Alex Campbell, PEI brief to the National Energy Conference, January 22nd and 23rd, 1974.
Prior to the mid-1960s, energy and the environment were looked upon benignly by political leaders around the world. Within a decade, both issues were global preoccupations. Prince Edward Island was briefly considered by some to be probably the world leader in conservation and renewable energy policy. This was a remarkable trajectory in which Alex Campbell's personal commitment and leadership played a critical part.
Environmental awareness and action.
The North American environmental movement emerged in a period shoehorned between the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962 and the celebration of the first Earth Day in 1970. In Canada, this period saw the development of environmentalist organizations, most notably Pollution Probe in Ontario and the British Columbia-based Greenpeace. These grassroots movements, plus growing public awareness, led to the creation of governmental agencies dedicated to protection of the environment. Canada's first environment minister was appointed in New Brunswick in November 1970, followed in mid-1971 by environment ministries at the federal level and in Ontario. Robert Skuurman was named Prince Edward Island's Minister of Tourism and Environment on December 1, 1971. His responsibilities included the newly created PEI Environmental Control Commission, which Skuurman said would address a number of pollution problems, such as solid waste disposal, operation of garbage dumps, and siltation of rivers. The Environmental Control Commission replaced the Prince Edward Island Water Authority, a 9-member body responsible for water resources and wastewater treatment that was created during the November 1966 legislative session. A critical issue driving the creation of the Water Authority in 1966 was harbour pollution in Charlottetown and Summerside as a result of untreated sewage, and to a lesser extent, industrial waste. These concerns would generate the biggest environmental investments of the Campbell years to upgrade water and wastewater systems in the two larger urban areas. Prior to being elected, Alex Campbell had been involved in lobbying by the Summerside Board of Trade to have something done about harbour pollution. In January 1970, Campbell and Earl Hickey met with Summerside Mayor Ross McKenzie and town representatives and committed to substantial provincial funding towards sewage collection systems and treatment facilities, to start construction not later than 1971 as a leading component of a Summerside urban renewal program. In the optimistic spirit of the times, Campbell declared that the province was embarking on a program to rid Prince Edward Island of pollution by 1979. The Industrial Waste Treatment Program, which followed quickly after the signing of the development plan, made funds available for treatment facilities at food processing plants at Seabrook Farms in New Annan and Langley's in Montague, with 1970 commitments totaling almost $650,000. In 1971, there were investments on a similar scale at Georgetown Seafoods and at Seabrook's Sherwood plant. In addition to Charlottetown and Summerside, water and wastewater systems were upgraded in Surrey, Montague, and Georgetown, with smaller investments in other communities. Despite these measures, there was growing public concern about the health of Prince Edward Island's inland and offshore waters, and growing public awareness of stream pollution and fish kills linked to farming practices. In June 1969, the Summerside Rotary Club sent a strongly worded letter and resolution to Cecil Miller as Minister of Fisheries, Industry and Natural Resources, protesting stream pollution that they said had decimated and destroyed the trout and young salmon population in many of our inland waters, and calling on government to explore the need for legislation, enhanced penalties, and educational programs regarding the use of sprays, etc., which are the sources of the pollution. Premier Campbell responded 2 days later, assuring the Rotary Club of government's mutual concern and contending that ample provision had been made in the 1969-70 estimates for not only the conservation of those natural resources, but as well for their promotion and development, notably through curtailment of industrial waste disposal. In his response, Campbell agreed with the Rotary Club that there was a tremendous need to curtail other sources of pollution in our streams, such as filtration, pesticide control, and so forth. He concluded on an optimistic note, saying, "All of these developments and the concern of many citizens such as yourself will, we hope, go a considerable way towards the improvement of this most serious problem." Campbell's prompt response was characteristic, and undoubtedly encouraged by the fact that the Summerside Rotary Club's letter and resolution were copied to 5 other community organizations and service clubs, as well as to the media and 4 fish and game associations. The ultimate concern of the organizations raising the issue of stream pollution was for the impact on PEI's popular sport fishery. Notwithstanding Campbell's 1969 optimism, the political and administrative challenges of circumscribing agricultural practices to protect island streams and waterways from pollution would dog Campbell for the balance of his time in government and become a particular preoccupation after 1974. In September 1975, Campbell told the Institute of Public Administration of Canada that "many of our agricultural experts, most of our farmers, and certainly companies and firms producing chemicals and fertilizers, have a certain mindset which requires a severe shaking. In my view, it is our governments which must do the shaking. Are we able?"
Concerns about growth, embracing the advantages of scale.
On May 28, 1973, just 2 days short of the 7th anniversary of the 1966 general election, Campbell made a remarkable address to the Charlottetown Rotary Club. Under the title "Between Two Cultures," he articulated an integrated vision that the economy, political power, technology, societal change, the land question, urbanization, and above all, PEI's opportunity to compete and contribute, were fused with a commitment to environmental stewardship and sustainable growth.
"Progress has come to mean simply more power, more profit, more productivity, more paper prosperity, all of which are convertible into standards concerned only with size or magnitude, rather than quality or excellence. One of the most striking things about this perversion of power is its almost total indifference to other human needs, norms, and goals. It seems to operate best in what is, historically speaking, an ecological, cultural, and personal wasteland. For any gains in human terms which might have come from this process are largely offset by wasted resources, depleted natural environments, crowded slums, and worst of all, by the degradation and depression of successive generations of human beings. At virtually every stage of mechanization, whether in its crude and early stages or in its final stages of eliminating the laborer altogether, the human cost have been heavy. Mechanization or industrialization of this sort has really only left man with one all-important mission in life: to conquer nature. To conquer nature in this context means speeding up natural process, hastening growth, quickening the pace of transportation, and breaking down communication distances by either mechanical or electronic means. To conquer nature is, in effect, to remove all natural barriers and human norms and to substitute artificial, fabricated equivalents of natural processes. It means to replace the immense variety of resources offered by nature by more uniform, constantly available products spewed forth by the machine. From that general concept of conquering nature, a series of minor or subsidiary concepts may be postulated. One, that there is only one efficient speed, faster. Two, that there is only one attractive destination farther away. 3, that there is only one desirable size larger. And 4, that there is only one rational quantitative goal more. Anything standing in the way of attaining these various goals has been characterized as signs of backwardness and inability to function in the modern world.
This was a strikingly open and critical reflection for a political leader 7 years in power and less than a year from an election. On its face, the message appears to be a substantial evolution from the promises of increased seniors' pensions and free school books of the 1966 campaign. However, one can look back to Campbell's early days as premier to find the seeds of his 1973 thinking. His views on the environment and on a particular perspective and role for Prince Edward Island were foreshadowed in his 1967 I Am a Canadian address at the Canadian National Exhibition. In that speech, Campbell pitched PEI as an ideal location for physical and social scientists to study national problems on a manageable scale, citing by way of example, "The pollution of our water resources can be approached experimentally and inexpensively." He went on to make a pitch for the island's greatest attraction to industry, the environment and living conditions which the island offers the businessmen, the laborer, their wives and children. Campbell's views on technology, environment, and decentralization of the economy were directly intertwined with his championing of a new role for Prince Edward Island and the Maritimes within Canada. 1 week after his Between Two Cultures speech on June 4, 1973, Campbell addressed the Maritime Provinces Chamber of Commerce. He called on regional business leaders to identify industrial opportunities that will not only provide adequate income, but also provide jobs which allow for meaningful participation on the part of the workers and add to, rather than detract from, our special environment. He went on to say, "Canadian business leaders must be awakened to the fallacy of centralization." He acknowledged that this would not be an easy sell. By way of driving the point home, Campbell said, "If we sit back and wait for others to take the initiative, we will be forced to sit back later and let them reap the rewards, and in the process perhaps rape our political, social, cultural, and physical environment." In November 1973, Campbell took his message to the Empire Club of Toronto with an address titled Cultural Revolution, in which he reiterated substantial passages of the Between Two Cultures speech. He cautioned his Toronto establishment audience, "We must recognize the dangers inherent in a frenzied, unheedful push towards the would-be golden age or utopia, which supporters of mechanization and industrialization suggest is attainable." Campbell did not pass up the opportunity to underscore what he believed to be the comparative advantages enjoyed by Prince Edward Island and the Maritimes, saying,
"In my province, we found ourselves in somewhat of a favored situation. In many respects, we have been observers of the passing scene. That is, we have not participated to the same extent as much of the rest of the nation in the trend towards rapid urbanization, dependence on the machine, and devotion to the materialistic lifestyle. In fact, Maritimers in general, and Islanders in particular, have been on occasion tagged as backward, behind the times, or rustic in attitude and approaches towards things modern. More often than not, in the past, we have tended to be apologetic of our rural background and lack of sophistication."
Campbell concluded his Empire Club address by calling for balance, saying, "Balance, to my mind, is the key word. We must carefully examine change so that we are able to discard those aspects of change which would be detrimental to our way of life, and at the same time, take advantage of those aspects of change which will enhance and improve our quality of life." In April 1976, The Canadian, a weekly publication distributed with newspapers from Montreal to Vancouver, devoted its lead feature to "The Gardener of the Gulf, the Greening of Alex Campbell and the Preserving of PEI." It described Campbell as the other philosopher king of Canadian public life, or rather, the unsung philosopher princeling. Journalist Harry Bruce wrote, "For years now, Alex Campbell has been sounding more like a spokesman for your local pollution probe than an establishment politician."
A culture of stewardship.
Stewardship was more than a philosophical commitment for Alex Campbell. During his first term in office, PEI became an early jurisdiction to regulate highway signage and billboards, with measures that subsequently became more restrictive, eventually limiting businesses to signs on their own premises. Campbell's daily drive from his family cottage in Stanley Bridge to his office in Charlottetown took him through what he describes as the Battle of the Lobster Suppers, with dueling billboards competing to attract tourist diners to St. Anne's in Hope River or to New Glasgow, 2 miles away. Campbell pledged to eliminate off-site highway advertising by 1975 and was unmoved by concerns that this would be bad for tourism, telling the annual meeting of the PEI Tourist Association, "I have not met a single person who visits Prince Edward Island for the purpose of looking at highway advertisements." The visual landscape was a hot focal point for environmental debates on Prince Edward Island, fueled on one side by islanders' pride in well-kept properties and tidy pastoral vistas and roadsides, and on the other by concerns about private property rights or the free market. Prince Edward Island was an early jurisdiction to restrict non-refillable soft drink containers and to bring in stiffer penalties for littering highways. The annual springtime roadside cleanup became institutionalized as a legacy of the 1973 centennial on Campbell's initiative. For the 1974 tourist season, the province distributed free bumper stickers reading, "We visited PEI and we don't litter." During the first Campbell administration, Municipal Affairs Minister Keir Clark proposed a program to gather up derelict car and truck bodies that had been abandoned in backfields, stream beds, or other locations throughout the province, and to bury them in unsightly excavation pits, thereby dealing with two environmental problems. The most ambitious version of the derelict car program was brought forward by Environment Minister Gilbert Clements in 1975. It encountered some of the stiffest resistance of any environmental initiative during the Campbell years, primarily as a result of a $3 supplemental fee for motor vehicle registrations to fund the program.
Energy supply.
The provision of adequate and affordable electricity was a primary goal and a major challenge throughout Alex Campbell's time as Premier, just as rural electrification had been a core issue for his predecessors. With almost all of Prince Edward Island connected to the electrical grid by the mid-1960s, and with expanding industrial and consumer demand, the province's annual electricity consumption tripled from 13,000 megawatt-hours annually in 1966 to more than 42,000 megawatt-hours by 1979. This increase reflected an expanding population and economy, changing lifestyles and increased industrial usage, including in the primary sectors. An early challenge taken on by the Campbell government, with support from the federal government through the Atlantic Development Board, was to complete the extension of more reliable and efficient three-phase power to rural areas, notably to support the kilns of a burgeoning tobacco-growing industry. A more pervasive problem for PEI was the fact that 100% of its electricity was produced on island from relatively small generators burning imported oil. This meant that Prince Edward Island was at a competitive disadvantage, with electricity costs among the highest in Canada. Plus, there was no fallback plan in the event of a system failure. PEI was even more definitively an island when it came to its electricity system than it was for transportation purposes. In parallel with the negotiation of the Comprehensive Development Plan, the Campbell government was in discussions with the Atlantic Development Board in 1967-68 for a $4.3 million grant in aid of construction of a land-based power cable to be installed on the proposed Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick Causeway. The cable would provide an interconnection with the Maritime Power Pool and give PEI access to less expensive power from the mainland. The proposed cable was shelved along with the causeway in 1969, while the Development Board made grants totaling $56 million for electrical projects in the other Atlantic provinces. Del Gallagher and the EIC argued unsuccessfully that PEI should be given the grant to invest until such time as the interconnection was feasible. They argued that they would dedicate the annual proceeds toward completing three-phase power conversion on PEI, completing the program of rural electrification, and offering selective rate reductions as a feature of an explicit and comprehensive program on manufacturing development. Alex Campbell and Industry Minister John Maloney became ardent advocates of an underwater power connection to New Brunswick, making various submissions over several years to federal ministers Jean Marchand, Alistair Gillespie, Donald MacDonald, and Don Jameson. The correspondence from Campbell and Maloney included regular references to regional electrical disparities and to Prince Edward Island as an electrically disadvantaged province. In a 1972 letter to Marchand, Campbell suggested that interconnection was the best long-term option if capital costs could be kept under $7 million. In February 1974, with the draft results of an engineering study, the cost estimate was raised to $16.4 million, with the federal government asked to provide 75% of the funding. In October, Campbell wrote to Regional Development Minister Don Jameson, indicating that the detailed estimates would be available at the end of November and cautioning that the total project costs could exceed $25 million. By December, the projected cost rose to $36 million. The interconnection cables were eventually constructed during the summer of 1977 and completed at a total project cost of $40 million, making it at the time the largest single project ever undertaken by the government of PEI. The federal government made a grant of $18 million and a loan of $9 million, with New Brunswick Power and Maritime Electric contributing $4 million. The interconnection, which linked Murray Corner, New Brunswick, with Richmond Cove, Prince Edward Island, was leased from the province to Maritime Electric and thenceforth provided the overwhelming majority of PEI's electrical needs, at prices considerably below what it would cost to produce from oil-fired generators on the island. For Alex Campbell, the benefit of reduced cost was a less compelling consideration than enhanced security of supply. Further, Campbell saw the cable as opening up the possibility that PEI could be connected to renewable energy sources and innovations, such as tidal power. As he explained at the October 28th ceremony marking the inauguration of the cable, although this province is striving to increase its self-sufficiency through the development of wind, wood, and solar technology, it is doubtful that we will achieve total self-sufficiency in the foreseeable future. So until soft technology is further advanced, this cable link will give us access to a less costly and more secure source of power from the mainland. Also, it will allow us in future to take advantage of other innovations, such as tidal power, when it becomes available. This cable will make our supply more secure, since before it was put in place, a fire or explosion in our main generating station would have left our province virtually freezing in the dark. The cable project was preferred to the prospect of adding to our present thermal generating system in meeting our intermediate electrical requirements. With these requirements now secure, our province will continue to pursue its long-range objective of developing sources of heat and power based on renewable resources. It was telling that, at the inauguration of a long-sought interconnection to cheaper electricity from NB Power, Alex Campbell chose not to boast about the short-term benefits, but to focus on the long-term prospects for soft technology and the quest for renewable sources of electrical energy. It was even more telling that he made no mention of nuclear energy or the nuclear reactor that had been under construction at Point Lepreau on New Brunswick's Fundy Coast for almost 2 years.
The nuclear option.
No issue caused greater division or indecision for the Campbell government than the debate over PEI's participation in the Point Lepreau nuclear generating station. Campbell's two most trusted lieutenants, Andy Wells and John Maloney, took bitterly opposite positions. Between New Brunswick and PEI, the Point Lepreau file caused friction in an otherwise highly collaborative relationship. After studying the possibility of building a nuclear generating station since the 1950s, NB Power and the New Brunswick government began formal discussions with the federal government and Atomic Energy of Canada Limited in 1972. By 1974, New Brunswick was actively promoting the construction of a two-unit nuclear plant using Canadian CANDU technology at Point Lepreau on the Bay of Fundy. The generating station would serve the needs of New Brunswick and supply power into Quebec, while Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island would be minority owners with entitlement to a share of the power. PEI would be a 5% owner of Point Lepreau. Nova Scotia dropped out early, once it became clear that the generating station would be built in New Brunswick. The $17.5 million capital cost, representing PEI's 5% share of the project, would be funded through a federal loan to be repaid by Maritime Electric and its customers. For the province, these were attractive financial terms. Alex Campbell was initially a proponent of the Point Lepreau development. In November 1974, Campbell wrote to Minister of Energy, Mines and Resources Donald MacDonald, protesting the federal government's decision against providing financial support for two 600-megawatt nuclear generators rather than one at Point Lepreau, saying, "I am most unhappy with this decision, since it is against the interest of this province and is a blow to our energy development plan." In December 1974, he sent a telex message to MacDonald confirming that the proposed nuclear power generator for the province of New Brunswick is fully endorsed and supported by the government of Prince Edward Island. It was not long before Campbell would shift to a more ambivalent position on nuclear power and on Prince Edward Island's role in Point Lepreau. The nuclear debates and divisions within the PEI government arose initially over the reliability of NB Power's cost estimates and became more widely divided over the environmental risks of nuclear power. Andy Wells went on a veritable anti-nuclear campaign. In a personal and confidential memo to Campbell on July 22, 1975, Wells argued vociferously against PEI's participation in Lepreau on ethical, environmental, and economic grounds. In September, he took part in an energy and people conference in Halifax that produced resolutions calling for a nuclear moratorium pending public debate and specifically urging Prince Edward Island to reject the proposal that PEI purchase a share of the Point Lepreau nuclear power plant. On October 29, 1975, the PEI cabinet considered a memorandum from Minister of Industry and Commerce John Maloney, arguing that a 5% share of Point Lepreau would achieve the lowest possible electrical power rates and reduce Prince Edward Island's dependence on oil. On the eve of the cabinet meeting, Wells wrote Campbell an acerbic 4-page note, warning, "Your colleagues in cabinet are so cowed by John Maloney's brilliant intellect and so frightened by his caustic tongue that it is highly unlikely that any of them would oppose, on his own, a position advanced by Maloney. It is therefore fruitless to expect a reasoned and intelligent vote on the issue. You and you alone are the only one capable of leading Cabinet into any other position." Following extensive debate, Cabinet decided not to proceed, with Campbell offering the public justification that the province's anticipated borrowing requirements did not permit it to finance a 5% equity share in the nuclear station. Campbell left the door open to a long-term power purchase contract with New Brunswick and indicated that he and John Maloney would be meeting with NB Power representatives to continue those negotiations. In December 1977, after a year of negotiation with New Brunswick and internal debates within the PEI government, Maloney sought cabinet approval of a 30-year entitlement agreement with NB Power. The key provision of this agreement was that Prince Edward Island would have the right to purchase 5% of the output of Point Lepreau at the same cost as New Brunswick customers. Cabinet debated the matter on three occasions, on December 8th and 22nd, and again on January 5th. The main issue of concern to Cabinet was not the financial terms of the deal, or environmental or ethical questions associated with nuclear power, but whether there ought to be a debate in the legislature and in the broader public before concluding the agreement. NB Power, in exasperation with Prince Edward Island's indecision after more than 4 years of discussion, indicated that the deal would have to be concluded by January 15, 1978, or that it could be off the table. The PEI cabinet agreed to sign the agreement at its January 5th meeting. Alex Campbell, showing his own indecision over nuclear power and smarting from criticism over previous perceived failures to consult with the public, wrote an uncharacteristically strong letter to New Brunswick Premier Richard Hatfield, protesting that NB Power's ultimatum was just short of an insult to the people of Prince Edward Island. Campbell's letter concluded by refusing to be forced into a premature signing of the proposed agreement before the PEI legislature and public had an opportunity for debate. As a further reflection of his ambivalence, Campbell's staff contacted Hatfield's office and requested to have the letter returned, unopened if possible, as he had second thoughts about its appropriateness. The letter was returned, but the deal remained unsigned. When the PEI legislature opened in March 1978, it was announced in the speech from the throne that the governments of PEI and New Brunswick had agreed to discontinue discussions of a bilateral power entitlement agreement since the Maritime Provinces and the federal government were considering a cost and risk-sharing agreement of major projects in the region through the Maritime Energy Corporation. The entitlement agreement with NB Power was not signed before Alex Campbell left office, nor was there a regional cost and risk-sharing agreement. Nuclear power was not Campbell's preferred option. Its main advantage was that it was renewable. Its main disadvantage, in Campbell's view, was that it was too big. Nuclear power was hard technology, while Campbell preferred soft technology. On January 5, 1976, he spoke to the Rotary Club of Montreal with the theme, "The Politics of Power," offering a sophisticated argument in which he quoted both E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful and Amory Lovins, whom Campbell had come to know through the creation of PEI's Institute of Man and Resources. Campbell considered big or hard technology, such as nuclear power, in the same light as he viewed the debate between centralization and decentralization of the economy, prophetically telling his Rotary Club audience,
"Those who live in the huge centers will have to contend with transportation, housing, and most of the problems that are in evidence today. Vast amounts of energy will be required to maintain these large centers. The lifestyles of the average citizen will probably continue to emphasize consumerism and consumption. People will probably become more regulated, and forces of social control will be in evidence. Decision-making and political power will reside in the centers of population. With our society already moving in this direction, it is comparatively easy for public utilities to follow the trend and invest large blocks of capital in very specialized operations to produce energy. In following this route, a strong emphasis is placed on frontier oil and gas supplies, expansion of coal for electricity and synthetic fuel, and rapid development of nuclear generating capacity. These are the so-called hard technologies. I want to make it clear that as a premier of a Canadian province that is short of energy, I am not condemning these methods of power development, but I am sounding a note of caution. I do not believe we will create the type of society we want if we all play the game of the politics of power in the same way. There are serious problems to overcome with hard technologies. Two of the most prominent are the difficulty of obtaining capital and the protection of the environment."
The Montreal speech reflected Alex Campbell's core political values. He told the Rotary Club, "I envision a highly decentralized society. I believe this is in keeping with not only our traditional values, but with our modern aspirations for a pluralistic society."
National energy issues.
In the 1970s, Canada had an active national debate about energy and power. No debate or public policy issue demanded more immediate attention, and no issue had more lasting electoral and economic consequences. In these deliberations, Alex Campbell's views were clear and unique. Until 1973, oil prices were pretty much an afterthought in public policy and even in private business thinking. That changed abruptly with the oil embargo imposed by 11 member states of the OPEC cartel in retaliation for Western support of Israel in the October 1973 Yom Kippur War. The embargo triggered a fourfold increase in the world price of oil, from $3 per barrel in 1973 to $12 per barrel before the end of 1974. In response to the dramatic rise in oil prices, Prime Minister Trudeau called a First Minister's Conference on Energy for late January 1974. In advance of the conference, Alex Campbell was interviewed by Globe and Mail journalist Jeffrey Stephens. As of mid-January, Islanders were paying 50% more for gasoline than they were paying in mid-November. Even worse, home heating oil prices had doubled in less than a year, and the coldest winter days were still to come. Campbell told Stephens that, in addition to dealing with petroleum pipelines and prices, he hoped the conference will begin to plan for the post-petroleum age. At the conference, Campbell spoke for a joint position developed by the Council of Maritime Premiers. The three premiers favored a one-price policy for crude oil used in Canada and a reversible oil pipeline from Montreal into the Maritimes. They proposed that the single price for crude oil should be set at a level which will not jeopardize the economic development potential of any region, and suggested that a reversible pipeline from the Maritimes to Montreal would be a major step toward energy security for the easternmost provinces. In his presentation to the conference, Campbell turned to a critical reflection on the failure to see the oil crisis coming, saying, "It should have been obvious to the oil companies, the electric utilities, governments, and the universities, to all of us, that in the absence of adequate energy supplies, a highly industrialized state just cannot function. The failure to recognize the obvious and resultant present difficulties have not been caused by ignorance, but rather by irresponsibility. Of this, we are all equally guilty. In speaking about the challenges that Canada would face in reaching a national consensus on oil and energy policies, Campbell accurately predicted the debates that would preoccupy the provinces and federal government for the balance of the 1970s. As he told the conference, "We will find that in any problem, which is as multifaceted as energy, in which technology, economic, resource allocation, and social goals or values will interact, it is extraordinarily difficult to balance costs and benefits and reach a national consensus." By the time the first ministers met again, 15 months later in April 1975, Campbell was ready to elaborate upon his vision for Canadian energy policy. In the intervening period, he had learned a good deal about energy and about the limits of Canadian federalism. Campbell told the 1975 conference that, after exploring the possibility of moving hydroelectric power from Newfoundland to PEI, he discovered that the prospect of developing regional or national energy grids was not very encouraging. He lamented the practice whereby provincial power commissions would buy and sell transmitted power at a profit. Campbell suggested that such practices were nothing short of barriers to interprovincial trade. He went on to say that power, like any other commodity, should not be subjected to interprovincial tariffs, and to call upon the federal government to exercise what we believe to be your constitutional responsibility to ensure that such tariffs do not persist. Campbell called for federal leadership in coordinating research and development of alternate sources of energy, and spoke about Prince Edward Island's desire to conduct applied research and demonstrate alternate energy technologies. He laid out an elaborate three-part vision for resource conservation, including what he identified as the most difficult area, the need to create a conserver society. He saved the most far-reaching of his submissions for the last, calling for the Canadian price of oil to move, over a period of time, to the continental price. Campbell conceded that he had reached this view reluctantly, and that it would have been politically expedient for him to insist on a hold-the-line policy on oil and gas prices. Instead, he argued that moving to the North American price would provide incentives to search out and develop new oil and gas fields. Campbell said that Canadians must recognize that oil, gas, and coal are a depleting resource, and all of us in this country must learn to adjust over a period of time to the ultimate moment when there are no more fossil fuels. He argued that the higher price would encourage conservation and help fund research and development of alternate sources of renewable energy. In addition, it would encourage current and future industries to adapt their operations to other sources of energy and away from rapidly depleting fossil fuels. Campbell turned from his multifaceted conservationist vision of a national energy policy to a heartfelt expression of frustration at the slim likelihood that his views would be met with consensus. He said that he was reminded of watching a child blowing soap bubbles with the knowledge that the bubble would eventually burst. Campbell drew the comparison.
"Our natural resources give us the material for our growth, and our expanding economy and rising expectations constitute the bubble which ultimately must burst when the resources run out. I am increasingly concerned that we in this country have too readily accepted the view that our problems will be solved through new discoveries and the location of new natural resource reserves. We must face reality. Unless we are prepared within the next 8 to 10 years to change our way of life, to develop new sets of values, to create a less materialistically oriented society, and to find new ways of growing as a people, other than by an ever-increasing consumption of our natural resources, we will have missed perhaps the last chance open to us. Have we the wisdom? Have we the courage?"
Canada's first ministers did not achieve consensus on the central point of their April 1975 meetings, which was to reset the Canadian price for oil. A year earlier, the price had been established at $6.50 per barrel, compared with $10.50 and rising on world markets. Ontario was out of step with the general view of the meetings, opposing any increase, with its manufacturing economy in recession. Ottawa and the producing provinces favored moving toward the North American price. With no consensus, The federal government was left to follow up on the conference with bilateral discussions with the provinces to find agreement or set a new price. Over and above the question of a Canadian price for oil, the more contentious issues concerned what should be done with the increased revenues. In response to a request from Prime Minister Trudeau asking the premiers for their bottom line, Campbell wrote on May 29, 1975, proposing an increase of $1 per barrel annually starting January 1, 1976, with three important qualifiers. That 100% of provincial oil revenues be included in the calculation of equalization payments. That there be a special compensation scheme to offset the high impact of increased oil prices on the economy and particularly of the cost of electricity in the Maritimes. And that some of the revenues resulting from increased oil prices be used to develop a stronger Eastern Canadian electricity grid. Campbell stressed the latter point, adding, "In this regard, we request the federal government to take a more active role to develop the grid." In the absence of a consensus, Ottawa moved to raise the price of crude oil to $8 per barrel before the end of 1975, with further increases in the course of 1976 to reach $9.75 per barrel by January 1, 1977. The premiers acknowledged the rationale for the federally imposed increases, but none of them took political ownership. When asked by the Globe and Mail about the 1976 increases, Alex Campbell offered a cryptic, "Alternate energy, anyone?" Rising oil prices meant a significant competitive disadvantage for PEI, especially since 100% of its electrical power came from on-island oil-burning generators. Alex Campbell and Industry Minister John Maloney were actively promoting various configurations of an Atlantic or Eastern Canadian electricity grid in anticipation of the underwater interconnection with New Brunswick to be completed in 1977. A key piece of the groundwork for the grid was laid at the June 1974 meeting of New England governors and Eastern Canadian premiers at Sugarbush, Vermont. The meeting resulted in the Sugarbush Compact, which envisioned the Eastern Canadian provinces as aggressively responding to the shortages of energy in several ways, such as undertaking large and costly hydroelectric projects, which in time could produce exportable quantities of electricity, the development of deep water port facilities, refineries, and tidal power development, and the New England states as representing a large consumer market for electricity and petroleum products, which is now and will be for the foreseeable future in acute short supply. In September 1975, the Eastern Canadian First Ministers held a conference in Quebec City, at which they agreed to undertake a study, to be chaired by Quebec, to look into the technical means by which the five eastern provinces can share, to best advantage, their energy resources to meet our collective needs. At the conference, Premier Frank Moores of Newfoundland spoke about further development of hydroelectric resources on the Lower Churchill River at Gull Island in Labrador, and offered to sell Prince Edward Island 50 megawatts of hydroelectric power on a long-term basis, conditional on arrangements being made to transfer the power through Quebec and New Brunswick. With this enticing prospect, John Maloney pursued discussions with Hydro-Quebec, and Campbell corresponded with Quebec Premier Robert Bourassa into 1976. Hydro-Quebec was prepared to sell short-term surplus energy to the Maritimes, but not to transfer power from Newfoundland. Bourassa wrote to Campbell in December 1975 to say that Hydro-Quebec had reduced its investments by $500 million and that it was his understanding that the Gull Island project had been set back several years. He added the somewhat taunting comment, "Besides, I understand you have decided not to participate in the Pointe-le-Preux-New Brunswick project, from which you could equally have been able to obtain the required quantity of energy." Campbell responded in February 1976, commenting that the Atlantic Grid Study was to be ready for presentation in late March, and proposing a meeting during the first week of April. With the Quebec election due in November 1976, which resulted in the election of a Parti Québécois government, the Atlantic Grid slipped off the table. The national and regional energy discussions were a reminder to Alex Campbell that PEI was a small player with little economic influence. He voiced his frustration at the April 1975 First Minister's Conference, explaining, "As the Premier of Prince Edward Island, I grow increasingly frustrated in the knowledge that my province and our people are virtually helpless in the face of national and international attitudes about growth, conservation, and the development of appropriate energy, food, and crop production and living systems." At the June 1976 First Minister's meetings, Campbell told journalist Walter Stewart, who published a series of interviews with all 10 premiers, "I suppose I'm in a lonely camp, but it seems to me that the whole psychology and methodology of anticipating 10% more growth in the economy and 10% more exploitation of natural resources year after year is leading us to economic chaos down the road."
Alternative energy in the Institute of Man and Resources.
Campbell opted to direct his frustration, along with his creativity and alternative vision, into the Institute of Man and Resources. Unveiled in January 1975, the IMR, as it came to be known, was intended to provide effective and audible leadership in the development of alternative and renewable energy sources and alternative agriculture and food production systems. Campbell told a Charlottetown audience, "It is my firm conviction that this unique approach will provide Prince Edward Island with an opportunity to alter its customary preoccupation with what Canada can do for Prince Edward Island to what Prince Edward Island can do for Canada, and indeed the world." The Institute was established by legislation during the 1975 session, although constitutionally it was a non-government body. After several attempts to attract high-profile outside leadership, Andy Wells was recruited away from the Premier's office in early 1976 to serve as the Institute's founding executive director. Wells was well suited for the role, with his knowledge of federal and provincial government and as an ardent and studious environmentalist. Through Wells' outreach efforts at national and international conferences and Campbell's series of public speeches, Prince Edward Island had become known in alternative energy and environmental circles, notably by people like Dr. John Todd of the Cape Cod-based New Alchemy Institute, or Dr. George McRoby of the Intermediate Technology Development Group of London, England, who had worked for 20 years with E.F. Schumacher, or soft energy path theorist Amory Lovins. Alex Campbell showed his personal and political commitment by joining the Institute's board of directors, of which John Maloney was the inaugural chair. In a demonstration of all-party support, opposition leader Mel McQuaid joined the IMR board as a director. In 1976, the Institute and Prince Edward Island stepped forward as perceived leaders in environment and alternate energy. Among the most high-profile occasions was a four-day March legislative hearing known as Energy Days. Organized by the IMR, Energy Days was telecast live locally and given significant national exposure. The well-concerted presentations laid out an assessment of the energy challenges and disadvantages faced by PEI, together with an elaborate case for an alternate energy future. Amory Lovins told legislators and the PEI audience that they were in the lead within Canada, and I think compared with nearly all countries. George McRoby came to Prince Edward Island for the first of what would be many visits, writing in 1982 that the IMR was one of the most carefully planned and well-structured efforts at energy and self-sufficiency in existence anywhere in the Western world. A second big event came with the September 1976 opening of the Ark, a $350,000 bioshelter built by the New Alchemy Institute at Spry Point on the eastern shores of Kings County. Dr. John Todd explained at the inauguration of the Ark, "What we are aiming to do here is to search for non-exploitive and less destructive ways of living and working with this world." Prime Minister Trudeau, who flew in by helicopter for the opening, offered an analogy to the 1864 Charlottetown Conference to underscore the expectations of the day. As Trudeau said, "I like to think that this island, which has shown hospitality to this political idea which created Canada, is now providing hospitality to a new commitment, a commitment that the environmentalists refer to as living lightly on the earth. I like to think that Prince Edward Island will be at the birth of this new commitment." Alex Campbell noted that the Ark represents a challenge not only to the new alchemists and the people of this province, but to governments and people throughout the world, to find no rest in our search for self-sustaining life on earth for mankind. The Institute of Man and Resources produced a considerable legacy of initiatives, either directly or through its influence on government or the private sector. These included programs in home and industrial insulation, with 64% of PEI households applying to participate, and $7.5 million in planned expenditures by 1978. And a three-year research and development program in renewable wind, solar, wood, and small tidal energy involving investments of $6 million. Andy Wells kept an eye open for opportunities to advance renewable energy through government operations, such as the August 1976 decision to install large windmills on the roof of new schools to be built in St. Eleanor's and Hampshire, or the pressure that was brought to bear on the otherwise arm's-length Charlottetown Area Development Corporation to install solar panels at its new Harborside development. The windmills intended for the schools were eventually erected at the North Cape Wind Test Site, and the CADC fended off repeated pressure from the Premier's office after concluding that the solar panels could not be financially or technologically justified. The IMR developed plans for what would become a successful energy-from-waste system, providing heat to provincial office buildings, the new hospital, and the University of Prince Edward Island. In June 1977, the IMR joined with the Departments of Industry and Development to bring forward to Cabinet a proposed provincial energy policy, calling for a multifaceted energy conservation effort in the short term and the most suitable mix of energy sources in the long term. Alex Campbell previewed the energy strategy in a speech to the Summerside Chamber of Commerce in January 1977. He told the business audience that PEI's future could be seen as a mosaic and that energy was one of the most crucial components. Campbell posed a series of questions. What kinds of industries will require power? How much will they need? How can we best meet these needs economically without harming the environment and in a way that will contribute to other social goals? In attempting to answer such questions, we must ensure that policies for our energy future will fit together with other parts of the overall picture Islanders have for the province's future. Campbell called for an eclectic energy future, one that would enable more and more Canadians to recognize the importance of a vibrant rural culture. He offered the example of a plan to establish wood-burning electrical generators in areas of high unemployment. He noted that this would also fit with our need to renew our forest lands and allow us to profitably use material that was previously considered waste and left to decay in woodlands. Two of the final acts of Alex Campbell's time in government were the creation of the PEI Energy Corporation in March 1978 and the approval by Cabinet of the Atlantic Wind Test Site at North Cape in August of 1978. The ARC and the Institute of Man and Resources both started with a flourish of public funding, notably through federal programs aimed at responding to the global energy crisis. By the spring of 1978, the funding situation had tightened up considerably, and the new alchemists turned the ARC over to the Institute. The ARC would cease operation in 1981, and the Institute of Man and Resources in 1990. Historian Alan McCachran says that, although Progressive Conservative Premier Angus MacLean appreciated the Institute's work and was on good term with Andy Wells, the change of government turned out to be a partisan nightmare and the beginning of the end for the Institute. Andy Wells might say that the beginning of the end came earlier, when the apparatchiks overran the visionaries at the Federal Department of Energy, Mines and Resources. Wells said that, not long after the Institute was established, federal people with ability and with a commitment to renewable energy disappeared. We found it difficult to find anyone in Ottawa with any impact, any influence, whom we could talk to. There wasn't anyone there. In October 1976, Alex Campbell sent a telex message to Federal Minister of Energy Alistair Gillespie, proposing federal funding of $2 million annually for the IMR as a minimum level of support to ensure first-year success and acceptance of the concept that Prince Edward Island is indeed to become a laboratory for renewable energy R&D. He assured Gillespie that the province's energy program would be backed by an even more significant provincial financial commitment to future development and implementation. For Campbell, this was finally an opportunity to realize the scenario of Prince Edward Island as a research laboratory that he had painted as early as his I Am a Canadian address almost 10 years previously, and the funding proposed was minuscule compared with the resources directed to developing conventional energy sources. It does not appear that Gillespie responded to Campbell's telex. The initial federal investment in the ARC came from the Department of Urban Affairs, with funds to support innovative human settlements because Canada was host to a United Nations conference on habitat in 1976. Campbell's final public speech as Premier was an address on alternate energy technology to the annual conference of the New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers on June 12, 1978. Campbell told his colleagues that PEI had approached the energy crisis as an opportunity and added the caution, To take full advantage of these opportunities requires a rethinking of much of the traditional and still current economic thought, as well as a restructuring of much of our economic and social policy at both government and private levels. It would be foolhardy to suggest these fundamental social and economic adjustments are easily and readily arrived at. Structural change always carries with it trauma, temporary dislocation, and resistance.
Piddly little things.
Alex Campbell's combined views on Prince Edward Island's place in the world and his commitment to environmental stewardship and energy diversity were captured in an October 1976 address on Energy Options for Canada to a group of bureaucrats and scientists at the National Research Council of Canada in Ottawa. He told his audience that Canada's choice of energy technologies may well be the most important choice our young nation has ever made, and went on to say that in social and political terms, the question of scale is perhaps the most important. Campbell cautioned against centralized, capital-intensive high technology, asking, "Is it wise to plan our energy future around further centralization, greater bureaucratization, dependence upon a virtual energy priesthood, and greater alienation of the ordinary Canadian from a vital force upon which he is increasingly dependent?" Campbell predicted that the capital needs of big centralized energy could be such that much of what might have been considered national wealth would have to be plowed back into the care and feeding of the national energy system. Following the talk, Campbell engaged in a freewheeling exchange with the audience. One nuclear expert, who thought the whole PEI experiment was bananas, asked Campbell whether it made sense, in the middle of an energy crisis, to be fooling around with piddly little things like windmills on top of schools. Campbell repeated the phrase, "piddly little things," slowly and with deliberate ironic emphasis, before responding, "I suggest to you that the energy establishment in this country could do with a good bit of shaking up. I suggest to you further that, as Premier, my mission now is to urge Canadians to start taking a serious look at piddly little things."